Sure.
You talked about several models, and it seems to me that, you know, whether it's ICE model or you know, the Amazon, what have you, and each model in context appears like as if you were dealing with separate life on, and yet there is so much dynamic going on. Some of these models are kind of like almost like a closed loop or feedback, and kind of some of them are indicators or leading, and some of them are lagging. So really one cannot look at these as if they were separate, but rather different pieces of a whole puzzle. So that's issue number one. Issue number two, you mentioned about the sun is changing, and that there is man-made changes to the climate. So clearly that makes the model much more dynamic to be revisited again and again and again to see what updates have to be made. The biggest problem we have in statistics is identification. We don't have a satisfactory model. And therefore, all these predictions, they cannot be the final word for where we are in relation to an ultimate model.
Yeah, okay, so let me just clarify something. The climate model results I showed you are roughly 21 distinct models. All of those 21 models include all of the components that I said, that include ocean, atmosphere, ice, land, and human activities. So they include the whole thing. Now, the accuracy of those components, the validity of them varies between models, but they're all trying to model the entire system. All models are wrong. Some are useful. All of these models seem to produce a consistent result that indicate this relationship of warming, and are also useful ways of trying to understand what will happen in the future. And I think that's about all you can ask for them. So, I guess that's how I respond to that.
I think we have to go on to the last speaker before any of the week. We will have time to. Hopefully we'll have time, or afterward, after the session, you can come ask some more questions. Our last speaker is Dr. Richard Smith. He's the Mark Reed Distinguished Professor of Statistics at my alma mater, UNC Chapel Hill. And actually, when I was there as a grad student, I unfortunately missed him because he was on sabbatical, and I missed his courses in spatial statistics, and I was forced to take them at NC State, of all places. So, but I'm glad he's here, and I'm glad he agreed to come today, so this is going to be a good ending to a good session, I think.
Okay, well, thanks, Bill, for organizing the session. I do not own shares in any company that produces solar heating panels or anything like that. I do have various collaborators, co-authors that I've worked with, but given the way I've pulled together pieces from different research projects, they may or may not agree with the conclusions I draw in this talk. So background. So IPCC has claimed, I think, Doug, didn't they somewhere use the word unequivocal? I know that's stronger than very likely. I thought they used the word unequivocal somewhere. Maybe I'm quoting for something different.
That was for the climate, actually. The global temperature actually warming.
Without claiming the human activities.
Yeah.
Okay, it's merely very likely that it's due to human activities. Well, thanks for the clarification. The three of us, Doug, Ed, and I, were all involved in an American Statistical Association workshop a year ago, and the ASA subsequently put out a report broadly supporting what IPCC did. And I myself, I don't want to appoint myself in any way at all as a kind of an arbiter between Ed and Doug on the subject of paleoclimate, but I mean, broadly, given the totality of the evidence, I'm comfortable with that conclusion. But that's about global warming as such in isolation from everything else. And there are lots of other phenomena associated with climate change for which I don't think there's agreement at all at the moment. And, you know, if those of us who are statisticians working in this field, I think there's sometimes a bit of a feeling that the real skill of all this is this area of research is putting the data sets together and that the actual statistical analysis often seems to be routine. Obviously, what both Doug and Ed have done would provide examples against that point of view, but I also would like to add to that point of view that I think there are many areas where there are actually really non-trivial statistical issues that have the ability to affect the eventual scientific conclusion. And I'm going to talk about that in two contexts. One is precipitation extremes, and the other is related. I mean, the buzzword is hurricanes and global warming. But to be a bit more precise, what I'm actually talking about is Atlantic tropical cyclones. So, part one, precipitation extremes. There's a lot of literature that has documented not only that is there global warming, but that climate extremes generally are becoming more frequent. And this literature is particularly strong in the area of precipitation extremes. And there's an extensive methodology that's been developed, and I'm just citing one representative paper here, Groisman et al. But with a few notable exceptions, what the climatologists have done have not been using the area of statistics known as extreme value theory. And I've been using extreme value theory in one context for another for quite a few years. So my interest in this was to see what extreme value theory might have to say about the problem of precipitation extremes. So I'm going to talk about, I've got various data sources. The main data source is National Climatic Data Center rain gauge data. Approximately 5,000 stations were used in this study. I'm also going to be using climate model runs from CCSM, which is the same climate model Doug illustrated in his movie. And there's also a third data source, which is called PRISM, which is it documents things like elevations in different and mean precipitations in different parts of the US. So just one slide about extreme values methodology. The essential idea is to fit a probability model to the exceedances over high thresholds at each of the approximately 5,000 data sites, and then to combine data across sites using spatial statistics. And the probability model we use for each site is based on something called the generalized extreme value distribution, which is being interpreted as an approximate tail probability in the right-hand end of the distribution. So I've just put one formula up here that represents the tail probability we're associating it with, which is in terms of three parameters: a location parameter mu, a scale parameter psi, and a scale parameter and a shape parameter psi. And this parameter psi is particularly important because it indicates the shape of the distribution in the right-hand tail. And in particular, when psi is positive, that means it has a sort of Pareto-like or Fréchet-like tail. So that's sort of the building block of the method I'm going to use. There are actually many other issues. I'm not going to describe the full details of the method because I wouldn't have time. But there are issues of both temporal and spatial dependence when we're applying this model to data which has seasonality, it may have trends. We're doing this simultaneously for a lot of stations. So there are two things that we're doing here that make this somewhat complicated. One is to let these three basic parameters, let them be time dependent, bring in seasonal factors by expanding mu, psi, and xi in terms of Fourier series and things like that, and also bring trends into the model. Now, that's a very flexible way of modeling seasonality and trends. A second extension is using spatial smoothing. Now, if you apply these sort of methods, we're trying to estimate, in this talk I'm using for illustration, the so-called 25-year return value, which roughly defined is the level of daily precipitation which would be exceeded with probability 1 over 25 in any given year. We can estimate that for each site, each of the 5,000 sites in our data set, but there's huge variability from site to site. You can imagine that estimating a quantity like that just by statistical methods is uncertain in the first place, and then when you look at it for different sites, you get a lot of spatial variability. Well, spatial statistics techniques similar to Krieging can be used to improve a lot of that spatial variability. There's another issue here that because of non-stationarity in the spatial smoothing, I actually divide up the US into 19 grid boxes, and I just put the picture up there. They're overlapping grid boxes because essentially what we try to do is to interpolate in each grid box and then smooth across the boundaries. So just as an illustration of what this sort of technique can do in the absence of climate change, if we just look at this as a technique for reconstructing return levels at different places, by the time we've gone through the 5,000 sites and then spatially smoothed across the sites and taken into account other things like elevation, we come up with a map like this, which you can see does have a fair amount of topographical detail on it. And I mean, that is a useful product in itself, because things like building codes are constructed around maps like this. But that's not the main interest in the present talk. Oh, just one other thing I will mention. You can construct a map like that. You can also construct standard errors associated with the map, which is an advantage of using spatial statistics methods over cruder interpolation methods. But the interest that I had in this was to put a linear trend into it. So suppose we're looking at rain gauge data over the period 1970 to 1999, and then in constructing those individual extreme value distributions, I'm putting a linear trend into each of the stations, and then based on the model that I'm fitting, I'm then computing a ratio of the 25-year return value in 1999 to the 25-year return value in 1970. And you can think of that as a measure of how much more extreme the extreme rainfalls have come over that 30-year period. And then if that's a positive trend, there might be some basis for thinking it's going to be extrapolated further in the future. What actually happens, as you see, you get rather a patchy spatial map here. And you know, it's not greater than one everywhere. There are places certainly where the map is less than one. But overall, if you average over that whole picture, it corresponds to roughly a 7% rise in the most extreme rainfalls, but with a lot of spatial variability, as you could see. And in particular, a region around the southwest that seems to be flat or slightly declining in the most extreme values. I can, if you remember that picture I showed earlier with the 19 grid boxes, I can go to each individual grid box and compute an average trend over that grid box, and 14 of the 19 have a statistically significant increase in the trend, in the extreme rainfalls. And the other five, which is basically those ones in the southwest, don't have a statistically significant result. We can use the same statistical methods to project future changes using climate models. And I'm using data from CCSM, which is the NCAR climate model. And there's the picture that I get for 25-year return values over 1970 to 1999. Now, that's a lot smoother than the picture I showed you based on the observational data. But as Doug was explaining, this is all based on aggregations in grid boxes. So you shouldn't expect to get a map that has the same sort of fine topographical detail as you get with the rain gauges. But the overall shape is similar, and using a future projection, we can do the same thing for 100 years hence, and we can then construct a ratio of return values 100 years hence compared with return values today. There are different scenarios for greenhouse gases that are used in these climate models, and this is under one particular scenario. And what you see here is that there are many parts of the US, particularly the northwest and the southeast, where we seem to be getting quite dramatic increases in the extreme precipitations. So there we are, clear evidence of an increase over the next 100 years. What might be wrong with this picture? I mean, maybe there's nothing wrong with it, but let me raise two issues that concern me. One is that although the overall increase, that 7% I quoted, is quite similar to what other authors have stated, the spatial pattern is quite different from, I mean, Groisman et al. Is one reference I cited, and other papers in the climate literature. And that concerns me. I mean, I'm not going to claim that anything that the climate people have done is wrong methodologically. I mean, I've read the papers. They all seem to be reasonable in the steps they took. But they're clearly different in various ways from what I've done here, in particular the treatment of seasonality. And the other thing that concerns me is that even when the same methods are applied to CCSM data over 1970 to 1999, the results are different. I mean, this analysis that I did with the observational data over 1970 to 1999, I could take the model output data, repeat exactly the same analysis and see what map I get. And it looks completely different. I mean, in particular, that southwest decrease in the extreme precipitation is not present in this reconstruction. So, conclusions, I mean, more sophisticated statistical methods really can produce different answers. It's not just a case of added statistical complexity for the sake of it. So that there's a reason why we should look at different statistical methods and try to think about the answers they give. And the second conclusion related to the map I showed you, just the last figure I showed you, is that I think it does show up the limitations of climate models in projecting precipitation extremes. Okay, that was part one of my talk. The second example I want is to say a bit about hurricanes and global warming. And I want to make clear that what I'm going to say is incomplete as a piece of research, but I think it illustrates the themes of this session very well, that there's actually some quite sensitive issues about this. So there are many recent papers that have documented increases in tropical cyclones and Atlantic hurricanes, especially over the last 40 years. These are related to increases in sea surface temperatures, and since sea surface temperatures are related to global temperatures, many hurricane researchers have concluded there's a direct causal link here, that global warming affects sea surface temperatures, that affects hurricanes, etc. So, for instance, here's a paper that attracted a lot of attention, partly from the date it was published, August 2005, a couple of weeks before Hurricane Katrina. Kerry Emanuel, who's possibly the top researcher in hurricanes, published a paper in which he showed the ISST is the solid curve here is a measure of sea surface temperatures, and the PDI is a measure devised by Emanuel called the Power Dissipation Index, which is trying to measure the severity of the most extreme hurricanes. And you could, the clear message is there's a strong correlation between the two, and they're both increasing. A couple of weeks after Katrina, another paper was published that got a lot of publicity. Webster et al. Also talked about increases in tropical cyclones with broadly similar conclusions to Emanuel. Just a couple of months ago in Nature, Elsner et al. Published a paper that, actually this is another example of where good ideas in statistics can translate to the climate field. They use a technique called quantile regression, which was originally developed by econometricians as a method of looking for trends in different quantiles of a distribution. And the idea here is if you look at somewhere in the region of the 90th quantile, this is a graph of hurricane intensities over the last 40 years. And if you look at trends in the right tail of the distribution, those trends have stronger slopes than the ones in the middle. And this graph down here actually plots, corresponding to different quantiles up here, they will plot the regression coefficient and the corresponding standard error. And the conclusion is that at the right-hand end of the distribution, most extreme hurricanes are becoming more frequent. But in spite of all this literature, there are some people who are standing up and saying not so fast. And I was interested in Ed's list of, doubters you said? Or one of the doubters on Ed's slide was a guy called Christopher Lanzi, who's a scientist who works for NOAA, and he's one of the people who's disputing this message. Now, the work I'm doing is not with Lanzi, it's with another NOAA scientist, Tom Knutson. Here's a picture from one of Knutson's papers, and it shows a reconstruction of tropical cyclones, not over the last 40 years, but over the last 120 years. And you can look at that figure, and what they actually did was to fit a linear trend from 1900 to the present day. There's the linear trend from 1900. And they said, well, that's statistically significant. By the way, they were using linear regression without any kind of a correction for time series correlations or anything. But they said that's statistically significant. And a second straight line that I don't think you can actually see on the curve at all, but it's there somewhere. There's a second curve going from 18, that straight line is the second straight line. The one from 1880 is not statistically significant, even interpreted as a traditional linear regression without any kind of autocorrelation correction. Now, as statisticians, we would look at that plot, you know, statistics 101 on regression, always check whether the model actually is a linear regression. And you'd probably conclude it's not and do some sort of nonlinear fit. But there is actually a reason that they're using linear trends, and I'll come back to that later. Oh, the other thing I should say about this is that there is the other aspect of this is that there's a huge debate about the accuracy of tropical cyclone counts pre the satellite age. The satellite age began around 1967, and the further you go back in time, the more uncertain these values are, and that particularly is a theme that's been made by Christopher Lanzi in a number of papers. What Knutson et al. Were doing here was trying to reconstruct, they tried to construct a correction factor by superimposing modern storm tracks from the satellites on shipping tracks from the 1900s and trying to use that to derive a correction factor. And in the time I've got, I'm not going to be able to tell you any details of how that was done, except that's an important factor in the analysis. I was going to give you some scientific facts about hurricanes, but I think in view of the time, I'm going to have to skip that. The one message to come through from this is that there are actually a lot of things going on with hurricanes. Sea surface temperature is one of the issues, but there are other issues like the wind shear, which is a factor, and it's not clear how all these different things are changing. So even though there's a correlation between sea surface temperatures and hurricane counts, it's not clear that this is a simple cause and effect relationship. And I will leave that as far as this is concerned. So let me now go back to... I'm actually using two different reconstructions of the Vecchi Knutson tropical cyclone data set. Here we are back with the linear trends and a few non-linear trends superimposed. And the reason why people like Knutson and Lanzi are not happy with data sets over the last 40 years or so is that you can see that there's a cyclic behavior over the last 120 years. And that cyclic behavior has been quite intensively studied over the last decade under the name Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. And nobody really, as far as I can tell, nobody knows exactly what causes the AMO for short. As far as I can tell, nobody knows for sure what causes the AMO. But the best guess is that it's a natural dynamic phenomenon similar to El Nino. I mean, El Nino is a warming of the Pacific that is known to be a consequence of the natural dynamics of the climate system. And the prevailing view is that AMO is something similar. And the difficulty with papers like the Elsner paper I was citing was that you do regressions over the last 40 years of data. That's an upswing of the AMO. And reasonable projections of the AMO is that it will start to decrease again in the future. So that's why people like Knutson want to apply, you know, a linear trend analysis over a longer period of time. It's an attempt to separate out the signal in the climate from the AMO. So I've got some graphs that essentially show that if you look at trends in tropical cyclone counts and trends in sea surface temperatures and you smooth them, they all look very similar. You can see that the tropical cyclones go up and down with the AMO. Well, I haven't got much time left that I can show you any sort of original statistical analyses, but let me go to a couple of points. Firstly, you can go back and redo the linear trend fitted to tropical cyclones And you can put in the autocorrelations and see what effect that has. One thing that's a bit surprising, that if you fit an armor model using AIC techniques, you actually get somewhat high order armor models. But broadly, they don't change the overall conclusion, which is you do get, for instance, from 1878, you do not get a statistically significant result. From 1900, you do. But then 1900 was at a low point of the AMO, so you'd expect it if you're following the AMO. In terms of a bivariate time series, what I've been working on is trying to build up a bivariate where we build explicitly the sea surface temperatures into the analysis, do a regression analysis that includes linear trends and includes residuals from the sea surface temperatures, and tries to take the time series features of the data set, you know, correctly, or at least we hope correctly, by identifying armor models. And we do get different linear trends. Beta 1 hat here is the linear trend, standard errors and T ratios starting at different time points. And quite a few of these results do produce effectively a p-value of zero. But they don't all. If I start 1880, I get a non-significant result. If I start at 1940, which is the other local minimum of the AMO, I still get a non-significant result. So the results do genuinely improve on just fitting linear trends without involving SSTs, but several of the results are indeed highly statistically significant. So I feel this is a step forward in the right direction, but it still doesn't resolve the issue about AMO. You still observe that if you start the linear trend at a low point of the AMO, then you don't get a statistically significant result. So I think further work is needed on that. Overall conclusions for the session. Although IPCC at least appears to have made up its mind about the anthropogenic causes of global warming, there remain many other climate change questions for which there is not currently a consensus, and I believe that statistical methods and statisticians have an important role to play in resolving those issues. Thank you very much.
Since we have had satellites, in fact, we have about half as many as we had in 1950. So the problem with sort of deriving a long-term time series is that the technology has changed dramatically, the positioning of the stations has changed, the microclimates have changed, and so blending these together in a reasonable time series is a non-trivial problem.
The speakers one more time. Okay, then.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Definitely.
Okay. That quicker. I just wanted to check.
Yeah, yeah.
Before?
Oh, Brandy, that's right. Okay.
I was expecting, you to be older.
Examples.
That was a very interesting session.
Except that I know that, I mean, that the presentation of Israel was actually taken from actually 2 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Within the last year, I've kept it just a couple of years ago. But also within the last year, there's no evidence of public
demo.
So that's the people just want to do it. So the Noah people will still say no.
2 years ago.
It's expensive to come here.
So we could preload our presentations.
Yeah, okay, I'm moderating, but I'm pretty sure you can do it here.
Oh, you've got to play it for all.